On the Wire, proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. Follow the pod on the Twitter at On the Wire Pod. I am Adam Howe, and as always, I am joined by the 2020 TGFBI champion, Kevin Haston. Kevin, I'm glad to see you. We had so much fun with Justin and Danielle, but it's time to move on. We're getting that much closer to Fab season, so we need to talk a little bit more about Fab specifically. Looking forward to diving into it this week.
Yeah, absolutely, Adam. Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here, as always. We got spring training games going. We got lots of drafts around the industry of all forms going, and we're getting close.
Yeah, we got TGFBI just started up this past Monday. How are you liking your chances of defending your crown so far?
One out of 435, the chances. But I do a team I'm putting together so far. We'll see how it turns out.
As many of our listeners are aware, Pitcher List Podcast Network launched earlier this month or last month, and it came with about 20 different podcasts, one of which personally I simply can't get enough of, and that is Dugout Study Hall, which hit podcast airwaves every Friday. Matt Goodwin and Alexander Chase, the guys that host it, do a great job of breaking down stats that we analysts spit out daily, and they translate them in a way that simply makes sense. We're extremely lucky to have with us the, quote, fake baseball economist half of the tandem, Alexander Chase. Alex, thanks so much for taking the time to break some stuff down with us.
And I am really excited to be here with y'all because there's a lot that I am totally clueless about myself that y'all get to talk about. We'll see what comes of this. I'm hoping it's not too much chaos.
Just the right amount. It's good. It'd be a nice little trade-off, if you will, because we're hoping to pick your brain and learn a lot from you as well. Alec, you know, could you explain to our listeners, maybe who haven't had a chance to check out Dugout Study Hall, that what they should expect when they listen to it, and they should be listening to it as soon as they're done here, of course. What does the title of fake baseball economist mean, or at least mean to you? And then enlighten them what they should expect listening to you and the, quote, expert layman, Matt Goodwin.
That's been my Twitter bio for a long time, since I like made my full dedicated baseball Twitter. I am not a real economist, and fantasy baseball is not real baseball. So I'm like double fake.
How dare you?
Yeah, I can't swing a bat. I'm not going to luck into a home run or anything like that. I am, however, at times someone who can use some of my teaching background to translate a lot of stats and math-ish things into human terms, because I feel like more so than some other people in the industry, I'm actively thinking about the ways that people are going to be confused. Like, I actually got started on this pretty recently relative to a lot of other people. Like, I didn't know what Baseball Savant was until like August 2019. And I started writing stuff up like a couple months later because I was just curious. I played in some really weird leagues and I wanted to know how to make things work. So Matt definitely has a little bit less in his like knowledge base than me, but he's also a teacher and is really good at asking questions. So I think we make a really good team in that like I'm anticipating a little bit of what might be confusing to him. And he's asking those in like authentic and like actionable ways so that I don't just get way, way too into the weeds. So the goal there is like to make a podcast that's supposed to help people who like either think they really know what they're talking about or really know they don't get from there to a good place, hopefully by the beginning or maybe just slightly after it into the season. I will say if there's one blind spot in our toolkit, though, it definitely is Fab. We may have to steal one of y'all at some point if we're not careful. So yeah, it's also been a really fun experience because I think both of us enjoy a lot of the same like non-fantasy stuff and can really just ramble really well, really well.
Definitely huge chemistry between you guys on the mics. So highly recommend everybody take a chance on that and make it part of your regular podcast routines every weekday. Fridays, right? Comes out on Fridays.
Yeah.
We love to talk Fab. That's what we'll be doing all season. Maybe by mid-season or the end of the season, we get sick of it. We'll see. You'll be able to tell it in our voices. But for now, we are really excited, and we're actually going to utilize what you bring to the table and analyzing those stats that maybe people aren't looking at on a regular basis, or maybe even don't have time to, or don't know what to look for when putting together their Fab bids and whether or not their Fab bids are going to be worth the money that they put forth. Because you should never pay for something somebody's done. You should only pay for something somebody's going to do. And that's the holy grail right there, is trying to figure out what's going to happen moving forward. So we'll get to that in just a little bit. But first and foremost, we're going to hit up our moving targets of the week. Again, these are players that we are looking at drafting at the end, in the last two, round or two of a 12-team league. or toward the end, at least, of your 15 teamers as well. So these are guys that are typically going post 350 ADP recent drafts. So we're not looking at ADP of drafts that happened in October or November, more drafts that have happened in the last, at least in the last month. Because a lot of things change and ADP changes drastically with that. I'm gonna let our guest knock it out first. Alex, it looks like you've got a hitter and a pitcher to talk about. When you start with your choice.
So the first guy I want to talk about is Josh Naylor. Josh Naylor is someone who confuses me in the fact that people don't love him. I thought that we were going to be all over him after his like really stellar playoff performances. Also, we're going to get into like why I care about these numbers, I'm sure, really shortly. But Josh Naylor's got really good and interesting toolkit as a hitter. So I typically like to look for a handful of different things. I want to know that a guy is making contact often when he swings. I want to know that he's swinging with the right pitches. And I want to know that when he's making contact, good things are happening. Naylor's got all three down, at least on the limited samples that we've got from him. So last year, he had a 90.3% zone contact rate. That's really elite. He had a 27% chase rate. That's pretty passable. And then his hard hit rate, that's a number that I don't always love, but his is fine. 34.1% at that much contact is really good. He's also not obviously doing anything too terribly wrong with his like launch angle. It could be a bit better, but he seems like the sort of guy who hits the ball a lot and hits it hard enough. But 11.5% K rate last year. He could walk a little bit more, I guess. He could hit the ball a little bit harder, but you got the basis of a guy who looks like he should be towards the top of a lineup. This is a first or second in the order-ish type sort of guy. And if the pop's there and his ability to run is there, he's going to get a ton of counting stats. I imagine he steals a couple bases. And more importantly, he's going to hit some home runs. Those are important things. And this is a guy who's in an NFBC ADTB. Let's see. I want to check exactly what it is for a more recent time frame rather than just quoting whatever it is. It's been long term, which is a bad habit of mine. Yeah, since January 1st, 390. It's insane to me.
Now, that has jumped up a little bit. If you look at 12 teamers in the last month, by at least the online championships, he's at 359. So he's still over the 350 mark.
Okay.
But the thing that sticks out to me the most there, though, is that there's been 29 online championship drafts in the last month. He's only been drafted in 5 of them. So he's going completely undrafted. He will be a fab target in week one. Or two, depending on how he starts the season or depending on how his spring training continues to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I do think that like the numbers I'm setting there definitely leave out a few things. Like, we're not talking about how much he's running based off of those numbers. And I think that's going to be a little bit important for a lot of these like fringy outfielder types. I know a lot of people are going to like demand that sort of stuff from him, but he's good with prospect pedigree. Wow. Okay. They don't pay you to make a noise as well there. He's a guy with prospect pedigree. He's drafted in the first round by the Marlins, actually. That surprises me. I knew he was a first rounder. So he's been around the block a little bit. This was in 2015. I guess that there are reasons why people are going to lay off on him a little bit, but I'm still excited. And the opportunity is there. There's nobody else in Cleveland that's playing a passable outfield to me. So I'm all over.
Not to mention that he could see some time at first base for Cleveland as well and get everyday playing time pretty easily. I see that. Cleveland's beginning of Cleveland's schedule. The only thing that really step back from Naylor is that when I'm making these types of picks personally, I'm definitely looking at the first couple of weeks of the season because my targets for the last couple rounds of my 12 teamers or even 15 teamers, I don't expect them to be on my team past month one, month two at the most, unless they just completely go off, of course. And so he does have a spotty schedule to start. He only has 3 games in that first time period of Thursday through Sunday. There's an off day. He has 2 off days the week after as well. So he'll have an off day on that first Tuesday and on Thursday. He might not see a bunch of playing time. He may not be in your lineup in those weekly transaction leagues. We have to set your lineup weekly, but he doesn't have a day off the week after, and his matchups are pretty favorable as well. So, the start off, he's got Detroit and then Kansas City, then Detroit again. And then he travels to Chicago to face off the White Sox. Then he travels to Cincinnati as well. So that second full week of the season is really favorable in his mind. So if you can hold on to him for that long, he might be a good little plug in for that, at the very least that week of the season, to see how he's doing.
Yeah, he's also a lefty, just a thing that I'm always looking for wherever possible. You want the guy who, if things tail off a little bit, he's still going to get 70%+ playing time if you're in the really deep formats. I guess in like the more competitive things, like a guy who's going around 390, you're not going to hang on to him. But it's not like the AL Central is just littered with like dangerous lefty starting pitchers either. I think most of the guys that I'm scared of there are mostly righties.
I'm going to skip over to Kevin. We got three pitchers. So I got a pitcher later. Alex, I know you got another pitcher in mind, but Kevin's got a type of pitcher that we haven't talked about yet in this segment. He's got a reliever in mind. So Kevin, tell me a little bit about your pick.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to touch on Josh Naylor really quickly, and nothing to do with stats or schedule. Just the top half of Cleveland's lineup is a really good lineup, and that includes him. Roster Resource right now has it Cesar Hernandez leading off, Jose Ramirez, Eddie Rosario, Franmil Reyes, Josh Naylor. He's going to have a lot of RBI opportunity, I believe, if he is indeed playing every day in that spot in the lineup. So I just wanted to touch on that really quick. And then, yeah, Adam, towards the end of drafts, I almost always pick a speculative closer. And I'm going with Josh Staumont in this instance, and it has more to do with Mike Matheny and Greg Holland than it may have with Josh Staumont himself. Now, Mike Matheny surprised me last year as a Royals fan. I was pleasantly surprised at some of the what I believed very nice analytical decisions he made that I was not expecting from him. At the same time, he still does do some things, what we would call old school. And that is why I do believe Greg Holland will start the season as the closer, because he's been a closer in the past. He's had the role. Matheny will go that way. However, any hiccup whatsoever, he's going to his 100-mile-an-hour flamethrower, just like he did with Trevor Rosenthal. And also, if the Royals are playing poorly and Holland is performing, he's getting traded. And then Staumont will fall into the role as well. It would just be later in the season in that instance. Yeah, it doesn't have a whole lot. Obviously, his 100-mile-an-hour fastball and his nice slider has a lot to do with it. But it has more to do with the situation in Kansas City than his personal statistics.
Yeah, I like looking at those speculative closers, especially in this day and age where you just don't know. You said it yourself, Kevin. You don't know, and teams are going to, if they're going to spread out their save chances any which way they want. My only worry about this year, especially this year, in picking a speculative closer toward the end of your draft is I don't know how long I'm going to be personally going to be willing to hold on to them. But what's nice is that he made that change in Kansas City last year quicker than I expected, getting Rosenthal that time. And so there's definitely a chance that happens sooner rather than later, specifically in Kansas City. That's nice. Something to look forward to. I have not gotten him. Have you gotten him anywhere?
Not yet.
Yeah. All right. There's still time. Still a whole month worth of, almost a full month worth of drafting left. And TGF got getting started.
I think I do have him in a draft and hold now that I think about it. But
That's the type of league that he should be. He was probably going a lot higher. That's the type of league that I would want him in for sure. All right. I'm going to jump to mine. And something that actually, Kevin, you pointed out to me recently that I didn't know existed. I think you mentioned it on a pod a couple of weeks ago, is those ADP charts that NFBC has added. Not only the ADP graph that you can see the like a draft, but also the average ADP changes that you've seen. And so the guy I'm looking at is Dylan Cease. And at first, I didn't think I was going to be able to pick Dylan Cease because of all the work, all the news that had come out of camp when pitchers and catchers had come up, all the news about how he had worked on his mechanics in the offseason. And Yasmani Grandal was ecstatic to see the changes that he's seen out of Cease. He called him a Cy Young contender. I don't know about that. I'm not going that far yet. But he's still like very polarizing in ADP. So he's gone as high as 487. This is in the last month. And he's gone as early as 247. Now, I just grabbed him in a DC at 374, excuse me. And so I put him on this list. We always say 350 or more. His ADP on average is a little lower than that, but I'm gonna cheat a little bit and go with it. He's also gone undrafted in online championships. Let me see, 13 times, 13 out of the last 29 OCs, he's gone undrafted completely. So what I like about him as a flyer toward the end of your draft, again, most of my analysis here is always going to be about the beginning of the schedule. He's got, the White Sox have four games in the first set of this fantasy schedule, that Thursday through Sunday spot, he is slated to be the number four starter. So he should get a start in that first week. So it's always nice to be able to slot in as many guys that are going to start as possible in those four, in that 4 day period. If he ends up being the fifth starter, he'll get a double tap in that first full week of the season. And if you look at who he's facing, granted that first start would be against the Angels, but if he skips the Angels, it's nice because he gets Seattle and then Kansas City. He probably hit Cleveland. He might miss Boston, but if he doesn't, that's actually not a bad thing. Texas, Detroit, and then Cleveland again to end out the month. So any grouping of these teams, not exactly striking fear in me as a manager of Cease on my team. Seattle had the ninth most strikeouts of the league last year. Kansas City had 14th most. Boston had the eighth most. Texas had the seventh most. Detroit had the sixth most. So majority of these matchups ended up on the above average half of the league in strikeouts. So that was the thing that Cease struggled with the most last year, was his strikeout rate. And so it would be nice to see those mechanical changes manifest into a higher rate for sure as a fantasy manager. And I think that he could do it. And what's nice is that you'll know really quickly in the season whether or not he's made those adjustments have come to fruition. And if he hasn't done it against these matchups, you'll have no problem dropping him and moving on. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think this is somebody that should be on everybody's radar, whether it be tail end of a 12-team, 30-round draft, 15-team, a few rounds before the end, most definitely in deeper formats, absolutely in AL only. There's just, I can't find anything that explains the much worse performance that he seemed to have, other than in ERA. But that everything else just looked worse last year. But his velocity was even up a little bit. All of his percentages were about the same, if not very slightly improved. And I think back, we can't always take everything a teammate has to say about a player 100%. But as enthusiastically as Grandal has been talking about what he's seen from Cease so far this spring, it reminds me of Brian McCann talking about Charlie Morton before Charlie Morton was Charlie Morton. It reminds me a lot of that. So I'm taking it into consideration.
Yeah, it's something different when your catcher's talking about your pitcher. Teammates, yeah. I get, but when your catcher, and Grandal has a reputation of being a catcher that works really well with his pitchers as well. So I take what he has to say with more than just a grain of salt. The thing about Cease too is he started off the season much better than he ended, as far at least when it comes to efficiency. He went on average five or more innings. He went six innings four of his first six starts. And he started to tail off toward the end of the season. So his last couple starts, he didn't break five in his last three starts. And so I do worry about, that. And again, it'll be more about, you'll know really early what you got and you'll be able to make the adjustments from there. All right, Alex, you did have a pitcher in addition to Naylor. I want to let you have this is a pitcher list podcast after all. So we should talk about pitchers as much as possible. Because I have a feeling we're going to talk a lot about hitters in our main subject. So hit me with your pitcher.
So I want to take a look at Luis Severino. And really, I kind of want to just use him as like a segue to talk about like settings just a tiny bit. I know that y'all are going to be really focused on a lot of leagues that look like the NFBC, where, as I understand it, y'all don't have an IL.
Correct.
So he's
correct.
Not that easy to stash. Mm. The thing that I would use as a baseline is if you're in any sort of league that's got a combination of like IL spots and bench spots, it's about six or seven in total, you should absolutely be drafting someone like Luis Severino way before pick 350. I am willing to take Sale personally within the top 200. And I don't think that Severino is much different in terms of the actual dice you're rolling there. And this is really just a statement of know what's going on. I think both of the guys that you guys picked are really good demonstrations of looking for people where the numbers could be lying to you in some respect. Stamman has, in addition to a lack of a role, also like some things about his underlying numbers that can lie to people in a little bit of a weird way. Like he's got this really high hard hit rate. It's because he strikes everyone out. He barely allows any contact. So the hard hit rate's kind of an aberration. It's a product of gunning for it because you've got nobody on base. And with C's, like, a little bit of the reason the numbers might be lying to you in aggregate is that they're representing a version of himself before their pitching staff, or pitching coaching staff in particular, definitely got better. The White Sox went and acquired someone to actually teach all of their elite former prospects to pitch. So they're people whose numbers can trick you. I think Severino's number that can trick you can just be like what your Fangraphs calculator is going to spit out, because it's really biased against people who are missing playing time. And I've written about this in the past. You want to, like, if someone's going to be dramatically different in playing time expectations, either above or below, be really suspect of what something like a Fangraphs auction calculator is going to spit back at you, because it's just not built to assess playing time. So as a result, it really breaks at the edges. I want someone like Severino. The potential profit is huge at that point. And if for some reason, A, he either has a setback, or B, you just really need the space, all that time you spent holding him, maybe someone else bites. Or you can drop him and just see what happens 2 weeks later. Maybe no one else bites at all. So I think that there are like really low-risk propositions, especially if you have mostly been doing things in like a well-built, really calculated, low-risk way for the first 15, 20 rounds or so, and you haven't already taken that home run swing towards the end, like towards the top of your draft.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the key, I think, Alex, is if you don't want to have too many of these guys. I was in a draft champions league where Chris Sale, Severino, and Noah Syndergaard were drafted by the same team. You can't do that, but it's a great thing. If you get into a bind and you have to drop him, it didn't cost you anything. He was your last pick.
Yeah, and me personally, I've had this rule of thumb, at least this year, has changed from years past, especially in a 30-man roster in an NFBC where there's no IL spots and no prospect spots or anything like that. I've given myself a one stash rule.
Like, yeah, that sounds like a good number.
So far, it's just been a prospect. I've been drafting, especially after our chat with Adam Lawler a couple of weeks ago, I've been getting Andrew Vaughn everywhere. I've been jumping him up, and with fingers crossed, he does get signed to a contract or he gets called up in the first month of the season. But he's my stash. And so
he had an absolute beauty of a home run. I think air quotes today. I don't know which day y'all are actually going to publish one, but he's already had some good footage out of spring training to get people all hyped and stuff. So good to see you there.
Nice. But yeah, it handcuffs me where I'm like, I'm not looking at an IL guy. I'm not looking at a guy that I know for sure is not going to be up until at least midseason. So like a Severino or a Sale or Syndergaard, the guys you mentioned.
One thing of those types of pitchers, the guys coming off of Tommy John, if I'm not mistaken, Luis Severino had the surgery first.
Yeah, so, and that's part of the reason why I picked him too.
Gives you a little incentive. Maybe he's the guy to take a chance on.
Yeah, and in my home league where I've got 4 IL spots, in my Yahoo league, Dynasty league, like those are guys that have been traded in the last like 2 or 3 years, like back and forth. And the guy who's got them now, he obviously going to hold him. He can just throw him on the IL to start. He doesn't hurt anything. Totally depends on format for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a home league where I'm going to be able to keep Sale for $2 this year. I am so excited about that.
Exactly. I do question like the guys that come out later. Sale's a totally different monster just because the Red Sox have nothing to play for. They've already come out and said, hey, we're going to use kid gloves on him at least this season. But like to your point, Kevin Severino had the surgery earlier. He might take some time to come back, but the Yankees need, they're going to need rotation help, especially in the second half of the season. So I think they're going to be quite happy with getting him back come August, or even by the time he's ramped up in August or September. So
yeah, that might be, he's already throwing fastballs. Like he's not throwing pitches with spin at this point, but he is throwing fastballs and has not had like a major setback at this point. So we can, throughout spring training, also monitor the news on guys like this just to make sure that as like the ramp starts to go up, like that's a weird way to say that, nothing major and terrible happens early on and we can at least get some of that news in.
All right, cool. Those are great picks. Of course, keep an eye on these picks and let us know if these are guys that you are focusing on at the end of your drafts, or if you've got ideas of your own, let us know on Twitter at On The Wire Pod. Of course, you can follow myself at 80 grade. It's all spelled out. Kevin at Hasting Kevin. And Alex, why don't you let everybody know how they can follow you and your pod and your co-host?
Yeah, of course. I'm at Chase_rate. Those underscores are nasty, but Chase Rate was taken. Still sad about that. At Dugout Study Hall is pretty straightforward. At Dugout Study Hall. Oh, I was really lucky. No one had a name like that anywhere in the podcast world, and I'm pretty happy about that. And of course, my co-host, Matt Goodwin, is at The Corked Matt. If you don't have a pun in your name, what are you doing anyway? What are y'all doing?
I don't know. What are you thinking about? All right, so... Of course, you can follow all of us and our pods on the Twitter, or you can pick our brains directly by joining PL Plus. Go to pitcherlist.com, sign up for PL Plus. You can talk to us through our Discord. It is very lively. Alex is one of the main reasons it is so lively. I appreciate watching him do so chaos, if you will, into the many different leagues that we run through the Discord and just in general conversations. Join us there and listen to us every week. Of course, our pod comes out on Sundays. And full disclosure, we are recording this on Wednesday. So if any of the players we talked about, any news comes out between Wednesday and Sunday, yeah, sorry. Hopefully it doesn't negate sure everything we just said.
That's why we'll be recording on Saturday evening during the season. That's a great point.
That's right. So we'll record on Saturday night to get as much of the most pertinent, up-to-date information onto the pod to make your fab bids on Sunday nights. Get listening to us early on Sundays with the most up-to-date information. So today, we are going to talk a lot about how you're going to make those fab bids. So what information goes into making those decisions? So many times we see a guy come up and hit, you know, three home runs in a weekend, and all of a sudden he's going for $400 on the next fab period. Sometimes that's the right move when it's Jordan Alvarez coming up and doing it. Sometimes it's a, you know, flash in the pan, if you will. And so we are here to talk to Alex about how to identify what those streaks mean, whether they be hot streaks and whether or not they're going to continue, or cold streaks and whether or not they're going to break out of them, or hot streaks that are going to just, again, are the flash in the pan and you don't want to spend your money on it. Maybe you keep a modest bid on there. Don't spend the farm on it. Or the cold streaks of guys that are just, they're never going to come out of this. That's just who they are now. So I'm really looking forward to picking Alex's brain on that and the stats that you should be looking at and what is going to be a good identifier for future success and not just past success. I said to you, Alex, earlier before we started recording, I'm the opinion you shouldn't pay for production that's already happened. You should only be paying for production you think is going to happen. So let's get into that first and foremost. So there's a couple of things that I'm curious about. Is that actually you said off air, what's nice is that you don't play in any leagues that have FAB.
I think I'm going to be required to next year a little bit more seriously. I know that the PL staff leagues, I didn't pick up a whole lot of people in them, I'll be honest. I didn't actually spend much of my FAB money. I felt pretty good about my roster and my seventh place finish. But yeah, I play a lot of more keeper format-y leagues. I get excited about stuff and I play some wacky leagues. So the rules are just kind of different. So I feel like it's something that I could get really into. It's just something that I haven't had to yet. So a lot of this, I'm really just giving you guys the inputs and you're going to be cranking back the outputs, which is kind of fun for me.
Yeah, which is nice. So I'll be leaning a lot on Kevin to translate a lot of what you're saying and how we can utilize that information on the FAB market. So first of all, we're going to talk about, let's start with hot streaks and players that are going into, they're just crushing the ball, the Jesse Winkers of last year type of situation. And I use him because I picked him up last year in my dynasty league. I've still got him and I'm going to hold on to him. But it was very obvious where he was hitting a home run like every day for 3 weeks or something crazy like that. And sooner or later, you just have to pick him up, or at least you feel like you do. So what is like... What I ask you is, what are you looking at when you're trying to identify whether or not a player is getting lucky on their hot streak versus an actual skill change that they're going to hold on to?
So there's one stat I'm looking to first, and like without hesitation first, and that's line drive rate. Players cannot reliably control their line drive rate. And it's actually funny because it's one of the stats that actually happens pretty frequently. Like people hit a good number of line drives. It's just really hard to do it. And that makes it really hard to repeat. If you look at a lot of guys who had a lot of pop-up success in different ways last year, line drive rates above 30% or so are pretty much the common denominator. Jake Cronenworth's torrid start, he was close to 40. Dominic Smith Jr., again, close to 40. There's often underlying talent that's going to come along with some of these sorts of like hot streaks. You have to also be hitting the ball a lot. You also have to be hitting the ball hard for it to matter. But that's definitely the number where I'm looking to see, is someone putting it all together, or are they maybe producing a little bit above their pay grade? So that's the first thing I'm always going to be looking for. The other thing is, if you're just like looking at purely home runs, those are really rare events, right? So like maybe just go back and check, like, what do those home runs look like? Did they squeak out the fence at 325 feet? Like, or did a guy crush a couple home runs and has also had what you'd call an acceptable contact rate, is striking out some number you could stomach in general? Because like, home runs are themselves outlier events. Good players don't hit a whole lot of them relative to everything else that happens. Miguel Sano is going to hit a bunch of home runs and he's going to strike out like 4 or 5 times more than he's going to hit a home run next season. Sano's got crazy power. I'm not bringing him up for any reason other than just to bring up like the, even at the extremes aren't happening that much. So yeah, I'm going to start there. In terms of kind of flipping the script and looking for stuff that's going to happen reliably often and not tied to outcomes is going to be the things I'm looking for. So it's, I don't want to look at something where there's 3 or 4 different things causing noise. So I might be looking to see if a guy's, I like to look at as a percent of like total outcomes, which like you can't do really easily, like their contact proportions. So like an easier way to do that, it might be just check, has a guy's zone contact rate changed substantially? That might be a sign that a swing change has changed in some reasonable way. Maybe someone's approach changed. Are they swinging more at certain types of pitches? Because those are the sorts of things where someone might have actually done something differently. From there, more contact might mean that something like a hard hit rate or a low hard hit rate, depending on the circumstance, might be a little bit misleading. But still, hard hit rate is actually something that players own pretty quickly. It's got some weird noise to it relative around the league because the amount of contact you're making will bias your numbers a bit. But on the whole, it's a pretty useful stat to tell you how people are doing. And I take it problems at all as a pretty good, like, how is this guy doing overall with his build number? Hard hit per PA is the thing that I tend to like best, but still, like, any measure of it, it still has a significant leg up on the rest of the field with contact stats in terms of telling you about the future.
Kevin, how quickly do you tend to act when you see a hot streak going on? Are you one that jumps over and wants to ride the train, or are you one that you need to see more?
I've come to realize we don't have time to see more. And that's, you know, Saris brought it up. I went to First Pitch Arizona in 2019 and it was paraphrasing a Billy Bean quote. Like, we don't have time. We have to make our decisions quickly and know we're going to be wrong a lot of the time, but we can't wait because everybody else knows too. So you have to make decisions pretty quickly and accept the fact you're going to be wrong often. I think of what Alex said, I love guys that are hitting the ball hard, but aren't producing. It's going to come. I feel like I've had some success with that. And it's just, yeah, you got to make the move when it costs you $2 rather than waiting and it's going to cost you $200. So make the move. And if you're wrong, you drop them. It didn't cost you anything.
So Alex, you brought up a good point about the things that you look for in these streaks, if you will. And you talked about some things that people own, like hard hit rate. They own it when they start showing it. But what stats do you think hold up best in very short samples? And I'm not talking about like a whole 2020 season of a short sample. I'm talking about a week, maybe even like a couple of games against a new opponent or something like that. So what holds up the best, or what's the stat that kind of holds up the quickest, if you will?
So, and we can actually talk about this for both pitchers and hitters, because to kind of give some background about like why I would know these things. And I promise you, for those of you guys who are at home and aren't going to go run to your computer and try to do this on your own, that's fine. Please don't. So one of the tools I'll use is something called a Cronbach's Alpha Reliability Test. This is a thing you do not need to know how to do on your own, but basically what it does is it tells you how much a player owns a certain stat compared to regression to leak mean. So at a certain number of PAs, you can trust this one person's stat like 50%, and then trust the league average for that stat 50%, and that's like what you'd expect going forward. So the faster the number goes up, the more reliable going forward something is. These are like the numbers that people are going to be using to tell you like when you can trust a number over a certain amount of sample size. And whoever you're reading from, there's a chance it's been like telephoned around and you're like hearing it a little bit wrong. So yeah, I just want to make sure that's what you actually use it for. And it comes from some weird stuff that I cannot myself program and have stolen from other people. But basically the trend is always going to be numbers that don't rely on anybody else and happen frequently, get tested often, we can trust more. So things like strikeout rate, that is absolutely going to be something you can trust quickly. Walk rate, you can trust pretty quickly. Hard hit per PA beats every contact stat. Even for pitchers, hard hit per PA beats walk rate. Pitchers own how much hard contact they're giving out of 100 plate appearances faster than their walk rate. It's crazy, actually, that I found this when I was doing research last November. Now, when we put these numbers in combination, things like K minus BB gets reliable relatively quickly because it's made up of two components that get reliable relatively quickly.
Basically, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's why it works, is because we're only putting in things that we know aren't bad. So imagine you're making a smoothie. The whole is not going to be a sum of the parts. It's almost going to be like a function of like how bad the worst thing in it is. Yeah, you put a rotten banana in there and it doesn't matter how the fresh the greens were. No, it's bad. So really, a lot of the stats I'm looking at is I'm looking, where's it rotten? What's the piece of fuzz in here that's like making the whole thing moldy?
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. It's like, how is this lying to you? It's like the phrase I'm always going to ask. So like with pitchers ERA, you can think, why is this lying to you? There's a million different ways it could be lying to you. For stats like Sierra or XFIP, they tend to have fewer fuzzy spots. They have less signal detectors. A lot of the things within them are going to tell you less about success, but they're not going to be lying to you. So that's just like a general trend. Once we're looking like on the individual basis about the things I'm going to care about, things like contact rate, zone contact rate, swing rate, hard hit rate, that are like little bitty components, can point you in the direction of like, where's a hot streak coming from? And then basically, if it's like something is good, someone is making more contact than they used to, you might like go in search of, is this happening? Maybe because they're a righty and they got to face five lefty pitchers in a row, or is it happening because they're better? It's always complicated. You guys know that, but you're looking for reasons why, you know, out of the darts you're going to have to throw, you can at least take out a few of them that you know are based on nonsense. And then you're just going to hit the target a little bit more than everyone else. I remember there was a weird streak earlier in the previous season where Garrett Hampson led off for the Rockies for like five games in a row. And he played well. A bunch of people were really excited. He'd faced five lefties in a row. Like, he wasn't going to keep the lineup spot. He wasn't going to keep playing well. And lo and behold, he didn't. We're looking for reasons why things are going to be a lot wrong. And
I remember you yelling at everybody in the Discord about that.
Yeah, I hate to be right sometimes. In that case, I didn't.
He's like, oh, look at that. He's leading off again. And Alex comes out of the woodwork and he's just, stop. Everybody stop.
That's being my worst, I'll be honest.
I love that. I ruffled some feathers not long ago. I said, everybody up in arms about Garrett Hampson needs to get playing time. He played the third most games for the Rockies last year and had the sixth most plate appearances because he hits down in the lineup. On base percentage is his problem, not the Rockies.
I mean, you can question whether or not the Rockies being bad at developing players made Garrett Hampson less good than he could have been or something else. But right, one way or another, that's not going to fix itself in the next 15 games. Yeah, there's a lot of this that we know we're going to be wrong on. So like, really, a lot of the things I'm talking about and when actually like a lot of the stuff we're doing on Dugout Study Hall is just like how to not be wrong. We'll call it how to be, but it's how to not be wrong. I hope that those kind of start to help you look for what you want to look for. I guarantee you, though, if you really follow those rules, the predictions you're going to make will, I hope, mostly follow along.
Very cool. I have a question, Alex, because I'm fascinated by something you said a couple of minutes ago. I love the discussion that's been out there quite a bit lately. Alex Fast and Alex Chamberlain and talking about pitchers. Inducing soft contact is a skill. You brought it up backwards. You said looking at hard hit percentage per plate appearance for pitchers sticks really quickly. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because that just took me straight to that other conversation.
I guarantee you we're all having the same one and we're just pointing at different things. Yeah, it is a skill. And that's basically my core idea. Like, I actually tried to make my own ERA estimator and it worked. It's still messy, but I built a hard hit rate based ERA estimator, but I use hard hit per PA. The basic idea there is pitchers are trying to do different things. I the piece I wrote, I compared Dallas Keuchel and Tyler Glasnow because they're like polar opposites. Like, Glasnow's gonna deny people hard contact by denying them contact at all. And Keuchel's going to try to get them to hit something out of the zone or that looks like it's going to be in the zone poorly. Two different approaches. So as long as we try to put them on an equal playing field, this is like the per PA rather than the per contact mount, that actually lets us answer the particular question, how much hard contact in total is someone giving up? And then you throw that number through the Cronbach alpha thing and it beats walks. Like, straight up, it becomes reliable faster. There is a data point. Our question is answered. Yes, hard hit rate per PA is reliable. Now, the reason I didn't use something like soft hit rate per PA or something like that, which is like 95 below, is that not everyone's trying to induce that. So I think it can be an unfair evaluator. However, this is something I'm still not done with, but I tried playing with K plus soft hit, right? Same idea as like K minus BB, but basically the idea is like strikeouts are a win for pitchers. Weak contactor is a win for pitchers. Let's add up the number of PAs out of 100 that a pitcher induces those and see how sticky that is to itself and to ERA. And guess what? It beat K minus BB. You can make predictions and they're going to come right a lot with this data. We just need to go make them correctly. And we're going to uncover so much stuff in the next year or so, I think.
Now I have to go adjust all my spreadsheets.
Yeah, I need to clean up my Tableau, but hopefully a lot of this stuff, one, you could pull it on StatCast really easily because you just adjust your total pitches to be PAs and suddenly it's there. It's really easy to find. Nice. Go do that quickly before TGFBI is over.
That's exactly what's going through Adam's mind as well at this moment.
Yeah, I'm on the clock right now. I don't know what's going on.
Did any of you guys draft Kenta Maeda by chance? You're like contractually obligated to draft him if you're in my presence because he's the guy who like stands out as like the best at this stuff by a mile.
I got my Maeda in my dynasty league, but I haven't gotten him in any redrafts this year yet. Oh no, I did. I got him in one of my OC qualifiers. So he's my SP1 in at least one league. So we talked about Garrett Hampson just a little bit. So that brings me into my last question about hot streaks and how much should we be focusing on park factors, the opponents that people face and playing time in the splits that we might look at. How much does that play a role in whether or not a hot streak is real? And first and foremost, Kevin, I'm going to ask you that question. Like, how much emphasis do you put into when you see a hot streak that's looks like it's being fueled by just a hitter going against a bunch of AL Central pitchers or a pitcher going against a bunch of weak lineups?
I'm absolutely going to look at it that because we talk about it every week and will every week throughout the season, only we talk about it backwards. We're going to talk about players going to Coors. We're going to talk about pitchers coming up to pitch against Pittsburgh and Arizona in a two-start week. We're just doing it the other way around. When someone does perform in those situations, we can't put too much stock into it. I can't. I shouldn't say we. I can't put too much stock into that.
So, Alex, in your research or just every day just looking at stuff, how much have you seen that those park factors in those opponent schedules have played a role in those hot streaks? And then once those opponents change or when those park factors change, the hot streak goes away? Or is it more often than not that they've made a change?
So I feel like there's a bit of me who tries my best whenever I'm looking out for stuff to be looking for that to begin with through the lens of trying to adjust your opponent quality with a bunch of stats. Like, I love WRC+ because you get to adjust for parks and stuff like that. So I don't know. I'm trying to keep myself from letting that bias seep in. Of course it does. I will say, though, that there's a lot of cases where you can write the story so that it sounds exactly like you wrote it right there. I'm trying to think, for example, Brady Singer last year had a really rough start to the year, right? He faced the Twins a bunch of times, but he ended up with some pretty good peripheral numbers. And then suddenly end of the year, puts it all together. It looks great. And that's a sort of case where it's like, you can tell the narrative, you can try to adjust to be like, okay, this guy's doing some things, but he's getting punished for not that bad of a body of work. And that's the sort of case where you want to be careful, but you're still going to be wrong sometimes. I mean, like Kevin Gausman, I remember he had a really good start. We all predicted Nick made him his like streamer pick, but he was also frustratingly good in some really hard to predict places and then not good in some easy to predict places. So I think part of it is just we have to have a natural baseline for how much variance is affecting everything anyway. We can pick out the obvious cases, but the non-obvious cases are going to be like staring us in the face too. I remember owning Framber Valdez in a league last year and being really frustrated at times. Part of that's Dusty Baker. I started him for that 7 earned run, 8 inning pitch game that he had, or maybe it was the reverse where it was like 8 IP and or like 7 IP and 8 earned runs. It was ugly either way. And baseball is a game where variance is going to happen, and you have to be okay with that. So I think on the pitching side, like, we're going to be better at identifying those things. And I think that also means there's a little less of an edge to be getting your opponents. On the hitting side of things, I think we're really terrible about it. But I also think that the bigger thing is not necessarily the quality of the opponent per se, but mostly just like looking out for guys' splits and how that's showed up. A lot of guys are going to play all the time and they'll play through bad splits. There's some like right-handed first baseman in the league actually that play all the time, and then they'll go and just crush a couple lefties in a row, and then they'll come back to earth. So you have to be willing to go look for those. The nice thing though is splits are pretty easy to figure out, and the even better thing about it for our thing is that like players don't tend to break the mold on their sided splits. It takes years and years and years and years of plate appearances to prove that someone actually has a demonstrable split different than league average. We're talking like a Kronbach's alpha, like to get to 50%, to get where your personal data is more important than league average data, of well over 3,000 PAs. So if a guy is a reverse splits guy for a season, smile and wave, because you should not expect it to happen again. And it'll happen because people have funky batting stances or something. But the fact of the matter is, if the pitch is being released behind your back, you're not going to be able to see it all that well. And that's going to affect how you play. So that means when you're going to try to figure out if someone had a good week or lucky in who I got to see, it matters. We actually started to see this seep into the popular discussion with the White Sox last year. They had a really righty heavy lineup. They crushed a bunch of lefties. They crushed a... Who did the A's pitch against them in the playoffs, like, stubbornly? I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been, like, Fires or something like that, where it's just, like, pants on head, why would you do this? And I think it still worked for them. But whatever. But yeah, like, we're starting to discuss this stuff in a more reasonable way, but it's still just the beginning. If we're trying to figure out, obviously, y'all aren't going to be putting fab bids on Eloy Jimenez, but he's still a righty. If he gets a couple lefties in a row in a week, you're going to be able to get a little bit more production out of him. And that's going to seep on farther down. Don't expect more playing time because a righty small platoon guy happened to face 4 lefties a week. It's not how smart organizations do things. Then that's about the best we can do in terms of like opponent quality. Obviously, there are changes in like qualities of different lefties and different righties, but it's tough. And I think the best thing is you want to make sure you're reaching for what you can grab.
Is that 3,000 plate appearance number the same as far as guys that seem to do exponentially better against the normal splits as well? Like playing DFS Nelson Cruz against the lefty is an automatic start. We hear that all the time. Is it still 3,000 plate appearances to get to that as well?
He's really good and he's right-handed.
That's what I mean.
Oh yeah, he's so really good. So then you can basically just add a bonus, right?
Even better against than a regular split. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, you mean not just reverse splits, but people who like are like above and beyond. But here's the thing. Nelson Cruz is 40, so he's had those PAs, so we can trust his splits. I think that's part of it. So I think I'm going to punt on the question a little bit here and say maybe he's just proving the rule about how much data you need to prove it. But like, actually, a really interesting one is Ketel Marte in his breakout year. The one big difference, other than his launch angle went up a little bit, but he became equally good from both sides of the plate. He's a switch hitter, so his splits are like he's on the right side no matter what, except he's just not on the right side of the plate. But he came like a 950 OPS side guy from both sides of the plate when previously that had been the case. Yeah, in 2020, he had a 587 OPS versus righties and a 1098 OPS against lefties. In 2018, it looks almost the same. But in 2019, suddenly like 973 and 998. My doubts about Ketel Marte is, were those 178 PAs against lefties an aberration? Or maybe not. No, pardon me. Not that against lefties. I got that backwards. His 454 PAs against righties. Did he actually improve and then just like happen to lose it in 2019? Or not? It's really hard to figure a lot of this stuff out. So that can be a really frustrating thing, is where like something exists and you're like, I also know that it's lying to me a lot. So I like to bring them up because I haven't figured out.
Which ones aren't lying?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Alex, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, cold streaks rather than the hot streaks. And I feel like cold streaks come up a little bit more often with veterans, or at least guys that have been around the league a little bit. At least you hear about them a little bit more just because it's like, hey, this is not what you expect out of this guy. So how do you identify when a good player or a veteran player is doing something different to cause the cold spell rather than it just being an aberration?
I think the easy answer to that, like, again, we'll start with the bare bones thing, is like, in someone's Landrid, drive rates just dropped. That'll be part of it. You'll see people who have these rolling ex woba or woba like charts on Vangraphs, and like, you'll set it to 50 PAs and it looks like someone's heartbeat. Yeah, that's just going to be a matter of like, when were the line drives that someone hit scattered about? A lot of these like rolling charts for what constitutes hot and what constitutes cold are going to be determined by the fact that a lot of these stats that determine long run success are pretty unstable. So like, everything about hot, flip it around. That said, there are definitely going to be people who are more prone to them. And I think that with veterans, I think you just got to be knowing who you're dealing with. So I remember last year, like Kyle Schwarber started cold, got hot, got cold again. And he's the sort of guy, because he makes less contact overall, it's going to be a little bit longer for things to stabilize for him. People who make more contact are going to be hot and cold a little bit less, just because the regression to the mean happens faster. It's going to be like the same number of balls in play, but they to regress back to the mean, but they just happen faster when you're Jose Altuve than when you're Kyle Schwarber. I wrote actually last year at the very end of the year about how Jose Altuve had stunk for the Astros. And then he like stopped stinking and it only took a couple PAs. And it was weird. It was really weird. He's actually the guy who accidentally turned me onto the per PA contact stats, is because I was looking at his slumps and stuff. If you strike out less, the slumps are going to end faster. And that's the only thing that we know, is just because strikeouts are more reliable and you just get more chances and your luck evens out quicker.
I think the focus a lot too, especially when it comes to Fab, is on these old, quote unquote, old boring guys that are just sitting on the wire. We talked about them a couple weeks ago, Miguel Cabrera, the Joey Vados, who have just started hitting these elongated cold streaks for some. And it's a matter of identifying when these guys might pop out of those cold streaks and return to form, if you will. We had a couple of guys last year just go on an entire season long cold streak. JD Martinez comes to mind as the obvious example. Yeah. And there's a lot of other variables that go into at least his example, but identifying who those veterans are on the wire that can help you in a pinch, or at least who you think might be able to help you in a pinch, besides the fact that maybe they're facing off some good opponents in the next week or two, but what it is that they could be doing differently that's going to continue the cold streak, regardless who their opponent is, versus what changes they might be making or might have just made recently that is going to elongate that or stop the cold streak altogether.
Yeah, I want to flip to pitching really quickly here, just like as a note. Okay, like there were some guys last year who started on a cold streak as a pitcher too. Like, think about that as pitching as well. Like, guys pitching poorly, we don't typically think about them in that same way. We just typically think that it's like, oh, someone's, maybe they got bad feel. Maybe you would call that, but you wouldn't call it a cold streak. You just say like, he's had a couple rough couple of outings. We definitely know that there are some elements of a pitcher's performance that are not under their control. They know that some things are going to be random and they're going to go in and out from one start to another. And then we also know that there are some warning signs that the bad's going to stick around. When Patrick Corbin's fastball velocity fell off a cliff in his first couple starts last year, like, that was a big red flag. Sell now. I ignored it. I held onto an odd new and I just dropped him like at the end of the offseason, because I was like, yep, no one's going to bite on this. So you want to think, is this something that I can write it off as the same dice that they've been throwing for a while, just handed poorly couple times in a row, or is something broke? And you want to just try as best you can to try to like think through that and look for places that would try to answer your question. That's what I'm frequently doing. I'm looking for, what can I reasonably answer with the stats in front of me that like tells me a real story that my eyes can watch? And you go watch Corbin's results, you watch Corbin's stats, and you can tell that narrative. Similar sort of things are going to happen for other guys who had like year-long problems, whether that's JD Martinez, whether that's Chris Paddock. I think that hot and cold are not oversimplifications at the end of the day here. They are meaningful things that do mean meaningful statistical things. So I hope that in the course of what to look for, really just like, the is something permanently broke, or are just like the numbers going to come up this way once in a while, or questions we got to ask her.
That actually makes me think of, especially when we talk about these veterans too, like, and you mentioned the rolling charts where you can see what guys have been doing in the past. Like, what can we learn by looking at either the rolling charts or just historical cold spells that, again, a veteran might have had in the past, and how they might've gotten out of it? Is there anything to be learned by basically looking at the adjustments they've made in the past, or are things usually just different based on which cold spell they're seeing?
So I want to go back to Kyle Schwarber. Depending on what you set the PA number to for those like rolling charts on, I use the Savant ones where you get to see their fun stuff because they have K rate and BB, but they'll also have an X Woba because it's interesting. Now I know that Woba and even X Woba are going to be influenced by the number of lag drives you're hitting. So I'm like, I know it's going to be a little bit funky, but if you up the PA totals to a more stable amount, they're set default to 50. I will never use anything other than strikeout rate at 50. I'm always going to be sending that to like 100 or 200 and just looking for the slope from there where it's going to be a little more stable. And you'll be able to get to see, okay, is this someone on a more prolonged cold streak? But if you're going to use those 50 PA numbers, you should just be able to know, it's like, all right, has someone hit the bottom of the heartbeat like this before and rebounded, and how often does it happen? Marcus Simeon, I spent a lot of time looking at his numbers because I was holding on to him for a while last year, mostly because I didn't have anything better to do with my lineup. And he's had bad stretches. He's had really good stretches, and his like steady year-to-year climb looked a certain way both on the 50 and the 200 PA scale. And I don't think there's anything like beautifully difficult mathematically there. It's just like, all right, let's go get some expectations for ourselves. And let's compare our current reality to those expectations. Have we been here before? And what's happened? You don't have to be a genius to interpret that stuff. You just have to be confident in what you're interpreting and go apply it reasonably. Sometimes that means you bail. Sometimes it means you don't. And I think context for different guys is going to mean different things there. I don't know. I'm really glad that I'm sitting in a lot of dynasty leagues or keeper leagues where the guys that I've busted on because of our particular rules, it ain't that big of a deal. I can just go back to the draft next year and you're just talk crap to my opponents while my team sucks anyway. That's what I play for, clearly.
There we go. It's just the smack talk.
That's why we all started, at least.
Yeah. That's all there was.
Yeah.
All right. So we talked a lot about veterans and identifying their streaks. I want to talk about the common phrase that we hear all the time, especially about rookies or at least younger guys, and that is the league has caught up to them and when they start to struggle. So it's hot, the guy's hot out of the gate, he gets called up, he's hitting bombs left and right, and then all of a sudden, or he's striking out everybody, and then all of a sudden he just can't do anything. He can either can't hit the ball or he can't get anybody out. Can you elaborate on what you think that means, Alex? And then how do you identify the adjustments that they need to make or that... No, oh, that's it. Identify the adjustments that they need to make to break out or to break back out, to get back into it.
I feel like there are like not a whole lot of these cases relative to what we'd expect. There aren't a whole lot of cases where a guy comes in, lights the league on fire using exclusively lighter fluid, runs out of lighter fluid, none of the wood is actually caught. You got like Aristides Aquino as like a great example of that. I actually think in a longer stretch, you could claim that Garver in Minnesota was actually doing something like that. And you might be looking like, is there something that's really extreme in both a good and a bad about what this guy's doing? Bobby Dalbec, maybe he might be that guy. Maybe not. I wonder how many times he got drafted today, Wednesday, like a 2-home run game in CGFBI leagues. <It's> like, we'll see how many times he goes. And you'll have that data to check in on, I'm sure, the next time you record and you can laugh about that. But if you're doing something that's really horrendous in one way or another, people are going to adjust. So it makes a lot of like contact-y sort of stats where you're just looking like, how good did this guy do when he hit the ball? Really difficult. Is not everyone seeing the same pitches? And people make adjustments. I looked a lot in the past couple of years at Ian Happ because I wanted him to be good and I was just willing it into existence. And he's a guy that I think you actually can go back and say, the league caught up to him in certain ways. He was striking out a ton. He's hitting the ball really hard. And then he got sent back down to the minors because the striking out was like too much for the Cubs. He goes down to AAA in 2019. He makes some adjustments to his game, and he basically does two things. He like changes his stance so he can hit pitches up in the zone more, and he swings more, so he's not like getting called out and called strikes near as much. And in 2019, he starts initially seeing the same sort of quality of pitches that he had been seeing, where people were getting him out up in the zone, and he just goes off on those pitches, and it's really effective. And he has a great end of the 2019 season. In 2020, people are expecting it, and the pitch mix that he's seeing changes pretty substantially. He sees much less stuff in the zone, and he adjusts back. He starts swinging less. I bring this up not to tell us anything particular about something to look for, but just kind of like tell us that like when you go look for it, the narrative of what you expect will show up. And I don't know that there's any sort of magic bullet of whether the league does catch up to people, but like, I mean, let's say you're a pitching coach and you got Aristides Aquino coming at the bat. People like Codify, I call them people, like an organization like Codify exists basically to exploit this. It happens. It 1,000% happens. And if you're trying to figure out if a guy's like real or not, like those super extreme cases, like they fall apart pretty often. There aren't a whole lot of people who have stuck in the majors with 35%+ strikeout rates, and most of them have more than one other skill that makes them good. I don't think that, for instance, Jake Cronenworth got figured out last year. I think he regressed because his line drive rate was big. I don't think that Bobby Dalbec's going to get figured out. I think he's just going to be a little bit less lucky. And I think that's one of the things that we maybe probably can do to fix how we talk about this. But I do think that there are people who these things happen to. And the way that we're going to notice that is if, like, the things that a player doesn't control that are, like, on the pitching decision side, like what they're seeing. Are they starting to see more off speed? Are they starting to see more out of the zone? That might be a sign they're being figured out, especially if there's an actual statistical basis to say that someone just isn't even trying to hit anything that's not a fastball, which seemed to be the case with Mitch Garver. He was guessing fastball like he was going against Tyler Glasnow at every at bat, and it worked for a little while. And then I think the Yankees just pulled up a scouting report on him whatsoever once they reached Minnesota in the postseason in 2019. My Twins fans friends will be really upset with me when I say that, but that's what it seems like it looked like. And then 2020 happened. I guess he was hurt too.
Lots of things happened in 2020.
Notifies can make a whole lot of money, I think, because this stuff makes sense. You just got to have enough data to actually act on it. And the faster you can react, rather than having to do manual scouting, if you can do it algorithmically, some teams are going to make a lot of money for some people, for their players, making them look a little bit better than they actually are, just because they're telling their pitchers to do the right things when other people aren't. And I think that's part of it. So that's it. I want Dalbec to be good. I want Aquino to be, because these adjustments can be made for hitters as well. You just got to know that, like, when your opponent adjusts, you have to as well. And I think that it's just simple as not being stubborn in some cases. I'm not calling anyone stubborn here. It's really hard to be a major league hitter. I can't do it. I can't even come close to doing it. I am not particularly athletic. Yeah, I think that the big package of this is we don't need to reject the eye test. We don't have to reject narrative. We just got to make sure that we test it. And sometimes it'll be true and sometimes it'll be false. Then our eyes get better. We go looking for different things. These days, I imagine like when we're looking at Dalbec's home runs, we're not looking about whether they got over the fence. We're looking by how far. And there are some people who are doing eye test stuff in like the 60s and 70s. What scouting work then? It's not like everything's gone.
No, it can be translated for sure. Kevin, look, what can you think of? Can you think of a situation in the last like year or two that you were like burned on a fab bid that you made on like a younger guy, rookie guy? I mean, of course, 2019, everybody remembers Fabapalooza, where you had three or four guys coming up, but then there's always somebody in your league that got stuck with Nicky Lopez. Sorry, not to pull up a Kansas City reference, but can you think of a situation that you were burned on one of those, and what you took out of that, what you learned from it, or things that you look differently at your fab bids because of it?
Actually, earlier in 2019, it was a move I didn't make. And like you just said, me being a Royals fan, the Nicky Lopez thing was, if he got on base, he would steal some bases, which even when he has got on base at the major league level, he hasn't even attempted to steal bases. So that's just out the window and gone. And in spite of his great defense, he's in big trouble for playing time this year. But earlier in 2019, Hunter Dozier, as a Royals fan, I did not get the benefit of Hunter Dozier's breakout on any of my teams, in spite of reading several articles before he started playing well about how hard he was hitting the ball and how unlucky he was being when he did smoke the baseball. And that's a mistake I try not to make any longer. And in fact, it's something I try to seek out. Guys that aren't putting up results, but are making contact and making hard contact.
All right, great. And then, Kev, I'm going to start with you on this one. But we talked about this earlier when I was talking about Dylan Cease and the very nice things that his teammate, Yasmani Grandal, was saying about him. And how about you elaborate a little bit more on that, especially now that we're in spring training? And that's all you hear, right? That's all you hear about your coaches and the beat writers and your teammates talking about players and the adjustments they've made and whatnot. How much stock do you put into that? And then what do you feel like you get out of that? And that's just not in spring training. That's throughout the course of the season as well. How much stock do you put into those kind of conversations or those, you know, quotes that you hear, those headlines that you see via press conferences, what have you, when you're making your fab bids?
In general, very little. However, as Alex brought up and we've talked about it briefly before in other conversations and gone different directions, when a change has been made, that we can see when that's brought up in the conversation of the manager or the teammate or general manager talking about it. Not we hear a lot this time of year about he added a pitch. Is it any good? You know, that does, but more especially like the Grandall and Cease thing, it really struck a chord with me. It really reminded me of Brian McCann and Charlie Morton a few years ago. It really did. So I'm taking note and going to pay attention. And we've heard about some changes Cease may have made in the offseason. We know the White Sox, as Alex said, the change in their pitching coaching staff could be a big deal. Lucas Giolito made his changes on his own. The coaching staff didn't do it. Now, that's probably why they have a different coaching staff now. And so these types of things, it's just there has to be something concrete for me to say, okay, there's a reason for me to believe what they're saying, I guess is where I'm going very simply. And it's so to answer your question, most of the time, it doesn't mean much at all to me. But when it goes along with something else happening that we can see, then definitely take note of it.
Alex, do you have any other insight into that? I know you focus a lot on what you can see, at least statistically. Like, how does hearing something directly from a coach or from a manager or even a GM or beat writer want to influence how you're looking at the numbers? Or does it dictate what you're looking for, or does it do nothing?
So I want to think about like why a coach would say something. What's he trying to get out of it? I think the White Sox are probably trying to get their pitchers to buy into changes that are being made. Let's be clear, like whether they're working or not, like the changes are working or not, Cease needs to make them. His stuff was not working. He's got a great four seam fastball in theory. I actually don't know if it's like good in terms of like things. It spins a lot. It goes fast. It's up in the zone. It's usually things we like. He also happens to have a slider that spins a lot. He throws it somewhat belt high very often, and its spin doesn't mirror his current fastball. That tells you he maybe needs to do some stuff differently. He also has a changeup. It's gone up in the zone a whole lot. He's got a curveball. He doesn't throw it very much. Actually, I'm not going to say anything about his curveball whatsoever. But like, you get all these pieces, and you're like a pitching coaching staff that it seems like they have a strong track record. These are the people who helped Kevin Gausman get good last year, who Drew Smyly get good last year. You take them, and you take Grandall, who has a strong record, and you take probably a lot of input from Codify, and you have a guy with tools that should be able to put them back together. You want to say something to him to tell him that he's doing a good job. That's why they're speaking. That doesn't mean he's good or not. We'll see the results. But think about like why something gets told to a beat writer in any sort of... Okay, so sometimes it's someone's hurt and you have to say something. Sometimes it's like your fan base expects it. I see it as functional. We see a lot of these stories coming out in spring training. I read one earlier today. The Astros are working out one of their top center field prospects at shortstop. And it's not that he's going to start playing shortstop. It's just, yeah, let's take this. We're having him there to increase in versatility. Read for the full purpose and for the full everything and don't get your hopes up. But if you've got some sort of working hypothesis here, maybe it's signal that a change that you expect to be made is at least being made. Try to fit everything to the theory. And if the data says that maybe it's possible they're making changes and they're going to fail, go look for reasons why they'd be failing or why they'd not be failing, why Cease would be successful. We'll get to see them, thankfully. We don't have to rely exclusively on Grandall here. I wouldn't suggest that we do that, but I'm going to be watching because I trust Grandall. He's got a good reputation for a reason. And there are so many other things going on here. That hunch, consciously or not, Kevin, I'm sure it's based on something that's not just like a hunch. Yeah, Charlie Morton, also good.
Exactly.
All right, that's all great. And we're gonna move on. We do have one mailbag question come in. This is coming from another Alex. Hopefully, I don't think it's the same Alex we have on. That would be awkward. I'm going to ask Alex to answer his own question. Alex asked, it's a pretty common question. I think it's about auctions. So Kevin, going to go to you first. Of course, this is your forte. Alex asks, how do you approach auction redraft leagues in terms of how many, quote, dollar days, you know, $1 or $2 players that you budget for and your team having? Are you saving money for the end of your draft, or do you figure the bottom of your roster will be churned anyway? I think that a more common term I've heard is the stars and scrubs approach to drafting in an auction. Kevin, how do you budget for those $1 or $2 players, if at all?
I have as few $1 players as possible. That's where there's some of the most value in the draft. And I want the particular guys in that area that I want. So it gets to that point. I want to be able to throw out my nomination for $2 if I want them when people can't afford to go three. That's where I'm at. I'll have very few $1 players when I come out of an auction draft.
Okay. And Alex, do you hit up your auctions a little bit differently, or are you?
Yeah, I feel like it's really a matter of like how you're choosing to answer the question. You know, like I feel like those dollar days guys, I think that includes like how many guys do you plan on rostering that are going to be in that $1 to $2 range, right? In general. And I think that the thing that often influences my decisions here is like how hot the room is. So one of the things I'll be doing is I'll be measuring like my projected value for a guy and how much they go for, and see how over time that number is being overshot or undershot. And if I realize that the room has spent like $100, $200, $300 more than I expect them to spend, that means the dollars that I have left are going to buy me more as long as I start using them quickly and appropriately. So if people like throw out a ton more money for like the first two rounds worth of guys, you want to feast on those $15 guys and make sure you can just get as many of them on your roster as you can. But you still want to make sure that that hotness of the room is still going to turn around and put you in a position where like the dollar days guys, you can throw $1 or $2 and you're going to get a lot of them. So that's like often the position where you're going to come out of an auction really good is not overspending just because you think everyone else is spending high. There's still the same budget as you expected. You don't have to pay more just because you're like permanently. Because your room is paying more. But you got to watch for the opposite as well. If the room is a little bit cold, you're going to end up with the dollar days guys go for $10 because people got to fill out their rosters and right. They got money left over. So that said, I do like to make sure everyone that I plan on having on my bench, like I'm not spending money that I could be spending elsewhere for an extra bench guy typically. I play in a lot of save and hold leagues, so I'm not spending any money on relievers generally. If you're in save only auction league, Lord help you.
Right now.
Yeah. Yeah, there's these the reason why we get out using saves. Like any, I total like my total bench plus my relievers, and I'm like, that's the number of $1 guys I want. If I believe in someone as a $1 guy, like Josh Naylor, I'm gonna pick him up for $1 at least somewhere, maybe two. But I'm not going out of my way to get more or fewer of those guys. They're very infrequently. Another thing you want to consider is if there's a position and you just know that you're like the $20 guys at the position, like second base. Maybe you plan on just having a $1 or $2 second base starter, but having a couple of those guys. But like a lot of it's going to be given by in draft position, like circumstances. If you find that you really like Brandon Lau and he's going an acceptable price to you, don't change your mind and just draft two crappy second basemen just because that's what you've decided to do. It's really going to be a matter of circumstance.
Yeah, I think that also the rules of your league are going to play a little bit of a difference sure. too. As far as like dropping, Alex, you talk about not... Alex, the questioner, questions about churning your roster with a bunch of $1 or $2 players. If you're in an on-new league, you lose some of that salary when you do start churning your players. You don't just drop a dollar player and then pick up another dollar player. You just spent $2 on that churned player because you're still on the hook for that dollar. So if it is on-new, I highly recommend keeping an ear out for the podcast Keep or Cut. That's Keep or Cut with both words with a K, with Chad Young and Pete Ball over on the podcast, the Pitcherless Podcast Network as well. And guys, I think that's gonna wrap us up. So first and foremost, Alex, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate the time that you gave us. So that's gonna do it for this week's On the Wire. As always, make sure to follow us on the Twitter at On the Wire Pod. And join PL Plus on pitcherlist.com so you can pick our brains and the brains of 170 other staff members of Pitcherlist on the Pitcherlist Discord. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen and give us a rating and review. It's always appreciated. It helps a new pod like us as well. You can listen to Alexander Chase over on Dugout Study Hall. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, you can read his work over at pitcherlist.com as well. Follow him on Twitter at Chase_rate. You can follow Kevin on Twitter as well at HastingKevin and myself at 80grade, all spelled out. For Kevin, I am Adam Howe. And with that, we bid you goodbye.